Hey everyone, this is Hannah, this is Texas 1031, and this is a Texas True Crime Podcast. Today I'm going to be telling you all about the murder of Anna Moses in the town I actually basically grew up in, which was Frisco, Texas. This case got more interesting as I researched it. It's a good whodunit, kind of a, not a basic murder, that's kind of insensitive, but a simple one, a typical one, a not a horrendous one. That is this all coming across really wrong? It's a sad one, but there's lots of characters that keeps it interesting. That's all I'm trying to fucking say. Anyway, so for all of you who ordered stickers, I did mail them like last week sometime. So if you haven't received yours yet, please email me. I rarely go to the PO box that the return address is at. So if it got returned, I doubt I'll know for a while, since again, I don't really go there because it's on the other side of town from my house. So just email me instead and we can try mailing it again. Okay. I am also working on some ideas for some legit merch, so stay tuned for that. Hold on, let me get a sip of water. Lastly, rate and review the podcast. Thanks. I would appreciate it. All the support, all the love you guys have given me through just the last month or so since I've been putting out episodes consistently, I really appreciate it. So picture it, Frisco, Texas, 2015. I'm going to butcher her last name. Anna Kachatova was originally born in Kazakhstan, and at some point, that sounded like Kazakhstan, start over. Anna Kachatova was originally born in Kazakhstan, and at some point in her childhood, she moved to St. Petersburg, Russia, where she would attend the city's main university there. Anna would obtain her degree in economics, followed by a short-lived marriage that resulted in a son. After her divorce, Anna was in her late 20s and doing her best to support she and her young son, Igor. In 1998, Anna was attending an English language class and had a chance meeting with an American tourist, Bob Moses. Bob kindly asked if Anna wanted to go to lunch one afternoon, and she said yes. Lunch turned to dinner, and the dates continued until it was time for Bob to leave Russia as his trip came to an end. Despite the 19-year age difference, the two maintained a friendship even after Bob returned to the States. The couple would primarily communicate over email and the phone until one day Bob flat out asked Anna to come visit him in America. In October of 1998, Anna made the life-changing trip to stay with Bob. She played it smart, though, and left Igor back in Russia to scope things out before having him come and join she and Bob. Anna wanted to make sure that this was real and safe. You know, she wanted to make sure that there was a true life available for she and Igor in America. By December, Bob and Anna were married, and 2 months later, 4-year-old Igor flew from Russia to join the newlyweds. They were honestly an adorable little family. Bob even formally adopted Igor as his own son, which was very respectful and, you know, a big thing to do. But their lives were put to the test in 2002 when Igor got diagnosed with a rare form of bone cancer. However, with the undying support of Anna and his new father Bob, Igor managed to defeat the disease. The family had been going through some ups and downs, but they maintained their strength and their love for one another throughout. Bob, Anna, and Igor started a new chapter by moving out to the up-and-coming town of Frisco. In the early 2000s, the area still had open land and pastures and was in heavy development. Bob worked in sales, while Anna got a job as a data analyst at the University of Texas, Dallas. While working at UT Dallas and living in Frisco, Anna immediately made friends and drew in admirers. Anna was cultured, outgoing, and vivacious. She intrigued people with her background and her overall personality. She was just a great friend and mother who seemingly had no enemies. Anna thrived on personal growth, new challenges, and life experiences. Dr. John Wierkowski, a fellow UT Dallas employee, worked as a professor on the floor above Anna. She showed interest in his class and his curriculum, and when she wanted to learn about his specialty, quantitative methods, yikes, he gladly assisted, and the two became good buddies, as he put it. Additionally, Anna was currently taking a public speaking course where she met Jerry Caspel, another man that became a good friend. At church, Anna would meet Donna Ross. Donna was a former ballerina who now taught dance in Frisco. She and Anna bonded over the opera, symphony, ballet, and art. Anna was also close to Jayshree Bihari. She was a woman who worked in the same department at UT Dallas with Anna. Jayshree remembers Anna being so welcoming and kind when she first began working at the university, and they eventually became great friends as well. Anna, honestly, she kind of reminds me of my husband in a way. He literally has, you know, friend groups for each of his hobbies, and some of them cross over from hobby to hobby, or, you know, his friends from work or college or high school, they cross over too. But it's just crazy to me that people are out there with friends everywhere they go. It's kind of a strange concept to me. I literally have one friend and she moved to Colorado. So who knows how long we'll be friends, you know? Anyone else out there friendless? Maybe. I don't know. People are kind of, they're overrated. So anyways, with Anna's social circle and social calendar getting bigger and busier by the day, her life with Bob began to suffer. It came as a shock to Bob when in 2012, after almost 15 years of marriage, Anna asked him for a divorce. He kindly obliged, wanting to respect her wishes, but the two remained friends and co-parents for the sake of Igor. Anna was now back on the dating market, and it didn't take long for men to notice. One of those men was Michael Stodnik, who met Anna on Match.com. Michael was quite different from Bob. He was about the same age as Anna, soft-spoken, and a business professor at UT Dallas, which is kind of weird to me that they didn't meet before. They had to meet on Match.com, even though they were employed at the same place. I guess it doesn't mean that they would have run into each other, but I still think that that's a funny coincidence, I guess. But regardless, Anna had found love yet again, and things in her life were good, and she was happy. However, on January 14th, 2015, Anna didn't show up for work. Michael, worried that he couldn't reach Anna that day, immediately went to the Frisco Police Department for help. Michael told officers that he had gone to pick up Anna for a date the night before, but she never came to the door. He explained further that the next day she wasn't responding to calls or texts and hadn't shown up for work on campus. With this information, police headed to Anna's home to do a wellness check and see what might be going on. Frisco Police Sergeant Jay Ream was one of the first on the scene to check on Anna. Sergeant Ream immediately noticed that there was no forced entry to Anna's home, and the house appeared to be locked and secured. This was a bit of a catch-22, though, because without probable cause, police couldn't enter the home. And if everything appeared to be on the up-and-up, officers couldn't lawfully go in and check on Anna. Sergeant Ream decided to work the call from a different angle, though. He asked the officers to locate Igor, Anna's now 20-year-old son. Igor was currently enrolled at UT Dallas studying speech pathology and was living on campus. His current focus was his music and his Christian faith. He even played in a Christian rock band, which Anna evidently wholeheartedly supported and loved. Police soon contact Igor, explain the situation, and head back to Anna's home. With alarm code and house key in hand, officers make entry, leaving Igor in the back of one of the police units. Officers spread out, walking through the home, looking for Anna or any significant clues. As they break off heading into various directions of the house, one officer heads to the garage to see if a vehicle was still at the home. There, lying in the garage, in place of her car, was Anna Moses, shot to death. Officers secured the remainder of the home, ensuring, you know, no one else was inside that posed a threat or was also injured or deceased. So now with the home a crime scene, the investigation into Anna's death began and detectives arrived on the scene in minutes. One of the investigators was Texas Ranger Reuben Mankin. Ranger Mankin and lead detective Brian Chudy. This is an absolute fucking Forensic Files because it is spelled so fucked. It is like how I didn't know this until literally maybe 2 years ago that you spell tchotchkes with a T. It starts with a fucking T. But his last name starts with a T-S, so yeah, good luck with that one. T-S-C-H-U-D-Y. Maybe that's normal. I don't know. So the ranger and the detective, let's just say, they did a cursory walkthrough of the home before heading to the garage. They are going to be the head guys of this case. My voice keeps cracking. This is so annoying. Okay, so neither of the men observed any disruption resembling, you know, kind of like a robbery or a burglary gone wrong, anything like that. The house was in good condition and it was clean and organized. Nothing really of note. Once the men made their way to the laundry room and garage, obviously their opinion changed. Gardening tools were suspended on one wall while a basket of plastic grocery bags and storage boxes sat near another. A typical garage, basically, just minus Anna's car. Anna was completely clothed, blood pooling from her mouth. Lying next to her feet was her black purse, unzipped, sitting wide open, still containing $300. Along with envelopes and miscellaneous pieces of mail near Anna's body were numerous shell casings scattered throughout the garage. Anna laid flat on her back, again, completely clothed. She was even still wearing a heavy coat, boots, and a scarf. A small bloodstain shone on the front of her scarf near her neck as well. Pulling down the long piece of fabric revealed a single bullet hole straight into Anna's neck. The investigators, they had a number of theories to work with at this point. Maybe she pulled into the garage and someone shot Anna and carjacked her. Perhaps someone was waiting inside the house for Anna to enter the garage and then shot her there. The options and scenarios were somewhat endless. In an attempt to pin down the vehicle early on, police sent out an APB for Anna's car. They also sent Anna's body to the medical examiner for review. The physician noted that Anna suffered from 6 .22 caliber gunshot wounds, 2 in her chest, 3 in her back, and a 6th in her neck. A 7th bullet actually fell onto the examination table during her autopsy, but it's just believed that when it was fired at her, the bullet simply got caught up and stuck in her clothing, never actually entering her body. Now with her injuries identified, Mencken and Chudy believed that Anna most likely had entered her garage in her vehicle, noticed her murderer, and turned to run away, causing the 3 bullets to her back. What investigators didn't understand, however, was the fact that although Anna had been shot 7 times, evidence showed 11 shell casings collected from the garage crime scene, but the additional 4 bullets were never located. With progress being made and an abundance of questions looming, Mencken and Chudy began questioning Anna's large social circle. So the first person they obviously go to is Igor. Sergeant Ream tells him, you know, there really isn't an easy way to say this, but your mom is deceased. Now we kind of have to figure out a lot of things like why and how and who and so forth. Basically like a typical, you know, death notification type scenario, except Igor gave an interesting reaction and response. You can see him on Sergeant Ream's body cam footage nodding along, really without any emotion on his face. He was simply staring blankly, but that's not too abnormal, I guess. A little more concern might be on average, but I'm not worried about his face. But then he says, like, is she in one piece? To which Sergeant Ream responds, well, I'll let you talk to detectives about that. To which Igor responds, I do have class to get to. I know that's kind of insignificant at the moment, but, you know. To which Sergeant Ream replies, yeah, I think I can get you excused from that. Igor would never make it to class because he would be taken to the Frisco Police Department for a formal interview that lasted around 5 hours. He told police he was in class the night that they believed his mother had been murdered and he knew nothing about who could have done this or why. Investigators were still concerned about Igor as a possible suspect simply due to his lack of reaction when he was told about Anna's death. Additionally, their concern grew when they later learned he told his friends some pretty offhand comments like, I don't want to have a funeral for my mother, and whoever killed her should be forgiven. They also found out that after his lengthy interview, he proceeded to play games at the campus's gym with friends all night, showing little, if any, signs of grieving for his murdered mom. Initially, his detective think this could be interpreted as a perfect example of not everyone has the reaction to traumatic experiences that you would think that they would have. That is until they do some digging to really exclude or include Igor from the suspect list. While doing their research, Mencken and Chudy come across a life insurance policy for Anna, listing Igor Moses as the primary beneficiary and issuing him $750,000 as a result of her death. They finally have a motive. However, Anna's friends thought differently. Donna Ross and Jayshree Bihari, two of Anna's closest friends that I mentioned earlier, were adamant with police that Igor wasn't capable of murdering anyone, let alone his own mother. The two were incredibly close, and Anna was in full support of Igor's life and the direction that he was headed. Anna's friends explained away his whoever did this should be forgiven statement with the fact that Igor had become incredibly wrapped up in religion in the last couple of years, and he probably said that kind of as an extension of grace or understanding, trying to do what the Lord would want him to do. In addition to Anna's son, Mencken and Chudy had several other men to interview regarding Anna's death. Namely, her ex-husband, Bob Moses. The ranger and detective arrived close to midnight at Bob's house the night Anna was found to deliver the tragic news. He immediately asked if his son Igor was all right, and they confirmed he was fine. The men originally wanted to wait and tell Bob what was going on after bringing him to the police station, but Bob was so insistent that they tell him what was happening while still in his house. Bob was shocked at the news. He was completely baffled. A far more appropriate and predictable response than that of Igor. Bob gathered himself and followed Mencken and Chudy in his car to the police department to be interviewed. They begin questioning Bob, asking him if he might have known what could have happened. They tell Bob Anna didn't just die, but they believed she was murdered. Bob told them he didn't know of anyone who would have wanted to hurt Anna, and he provided a timeline to investigators for his whereabouts for Tuesday, January 13th. Bob told Mencken and Chudy that he shared his home with three other men. One of the roommates, a man named Ken, could corroborate Bob's alibi, which was that he was at home all day watching replays and commentary of post-game footage from the Ohio State victory that occurred the day prior. He also said that it was so cold out that day that he didn't even leave his house until around 7 p.m. to go down to good old Twin Peaks near his neighborhood for dinner. Bob was even seen on the bar's security footage wearing his Ohio State jacket. The men continued asking Bob about his now defunct marriage to Anna. Bob admitted that they had divorced a few years prior and that they had some arguments and disagreements, but really, the marriage ended because they just grew apart. They asked Bob if he owned any firearms, and Bob says, "Yeah, I have five of them." Three of them were .22s, the same caliber that was used to murder his ex-wife. Bob willingly offers up his home, ammunition, and his guns for search, analysis, and processing. He even provides a DNA sample right there in the interview room. Bob was only at the police department for about an hour before he was allowed to leave to go find Igor. The father and son moved into Anna's home and spent time together grieving her loss. Around 12 hours after Anna was found dead, patrol alerts Detective Chudy that they had located Anna's vehicle just a few streets away from her home. The bluish-silver Hyundai Sonata was parked inconspicuously, woven in between other random cars on the nearby street. The patrol officer noted that he could see a blood stain inside the vehicle from where he stood looking into the car. And he was right. The three blood spots were found on the car's seat bottom, so like the part that you sit in, the back of the seat where your back leans against, and the center console. Additionally, a Red Bull can and an old stomped-out cigarette were also found in the sedan. The car was taken to the crime lab, where CSI technicians didn't find any usable fingerprints, but they did send off the bloodstain samples along with the swabs from the Red Bull can and cigarette butt for DNA testing. Investigators knew they had some time on their hands while they waited for the results, so they continued their search into Anna's personal life. Mencken and Chudy were able to retrieve some digital evidence, giving them some idea to what Anna did on her last day. They tracked down some camera footage showing her leaving the UT Dallas campus around 5:07, along with a video of Anna at a Taco Bell drive-thru on her way home. Another camera from a house in her neighborhood showed Anna arriving home around 5:49. Now that investigators had set Bob and Igor aside for the moment, they brought in their persons of interest list, starting with Anna's boyfriend, Michael Stodnik. Michael, who remember was the one who had called police to check on Anna, was contacted by investigators and asked to come down to the police station to be interviewed. He told them that he had been at his daughter's elementary school earlier in the evening, drove to pick up Anna for their date, but couldn't get into the house or reach her, so he left. Unlike Igor or Bob, during Michael's interview, he asked for an attorney. So with Michael lawyered up, Mencken and Chudy, they still had other men to rule out. One being Jerry Caspel, a man Anna had met at her public speaking course, like I mentioned. Jerry considered Anna his muse, using her as inspiration for his poems and songs. Jerry was a married father and simply considered Anna as a deeply close friend and nothing more. But investigators didn't take him at his word. They asked Jerry if he owned any firearms, and he said yes, a single .22 he used for target shooting. Interestingly, Jerry also told law enforcement that he had no idea Anna was in a relationship and had never heard her mention a man named Michael. Next on the list of men in Anna's life was one that was quite close, but not in the way you might think. A man named David Stafford lived directly across the street from Anna. The two were friendly acquaintances, the kind of relationship most people have with their neighbors. But when he was questioned by officers, David had a lot more to offer up about Anna and her love life than expected. To me, David has a curious case of like rear window or Disturbia syndrome. This guy is kind of strange. His office was at the front of his home and it looked directly across the road to Anna's front yard and door. So according to him, he inadvertently knew a lot about her routine. Furthermore, David told police that he would notice that over the course of 3 to 5 months, several different men with different vehicles were rotating in and out of Anna's home and her life. He claimed he was never personally interested in asking Anna out because of her heavy Russian accent and that it was essentially a turnoff to him. Nice, Dave. Good one. Yeah, David's alibi was that he was on a long conference call on the night of Anna's murder and he never heard any gunshots, but he cooperated and he added his DNA to the suspect pool as well. Moving back a little closer into Anna's circle was co-worker, the professor, Dr. John Workowski. He and Anna became especially close in 2012 when her marriage to Bob became rocky. The two would spend the morning together drinking tea on campus and catching up. The innocent coffee breaks, however, eventually evolved into a bit of a romance while Anna and Bob were still married. Dr. Wachowski told police that he broke off the fling, citing their 30-year age difference was to blame, and the two returned to being friends. Guys, Dr. Wachowski is definitely older than Anna. He wears some sick-ass polyester brown pants from probably the 1970s when he started teaching. He chain smokes while he walks around campus, and he never fucking looks at the camera. It's incredible. I don't know. It's a vibe. It's something. I'm all for it. So what Megan and Trudy come to find out is that Anna was most likely solely interested in the professor because he was paying her bills. Over the course of their situationship, Dr. Wachowski would give Anna $46,000. She wouldn't go and blow the money, though. Anna used his funds to fly her mother over from Russia and to pay for Igor's college expenses. Just days before her death, he had actually given her another $6,000. The gracious professor claimed Anna was simply just his personal charity case, and that was all. Mm-hmm. All of these relationships and things going on behind the scenes were all exposed and came as a shock to her friends Donna and Jayshree. Just like Jerry not knowing about Michael, the women didn't know about Dr. Wachowski. Anna had woven a wide, entangled web for herself, and it was trying to be unwound by Mankin and Chudy little by little. They would soon get access to Anna's bank accounts and realize that she had over $100,000 available for spending. This was curious since her data analyst job was most likely not allotting her that amount of money. So if the doctor gave her around half of that, where did the remainder come from? So much of Anna's life was a secret, or at least kept incredibly private. She juggled friends, jobs, marriages, and romances. A lot of this information about the people in her life came to light at her funeral, where everyone was finally able to put a face to a name, or vice versa. Donna Ross remembers while she was sitting at the memorial that it dawned on her that it was most likely someone close to Anna that murdered her, and the person was probably in the room with everyone, putting up a disgusting facade of innocence. Soon, though, persons of interest began dropping off of the investigators' list, and the suspect pool became smaller and smaller. Igor, despite his unusual reaction to his mother's murder, had a very solid alibi. He was in class 45 minutes away at the time law enforcement believed Anna was killed. They also ruled out David Stafford. Despite being home, they have digital evidence that he was on the conference call, like he said. They also confirmed that Michael Stodnik, Anna's boyfriend, was at his daughter's school event all the way in Grapevine. He was even captured on security footage from the school's cameras. Bob Moses spent the day at home and then was at Twin Peaks for the evening, also seen on camera. What about Jerry and John, the quirky professor and poet? Both seemed to be more than enamored with Anna and possibly crossed the line in their relationship with her. Ironically or coincidentally, I guess I should say, both men had the same alibi. They were both driving on the Dallas Toll Road during the time of Anna's murder and were nowhere near her home. They had basically eliminated everyone on their suspect list, and the investigation was slowing down. Several weeks went by without any progress in the case. That is, until a secret letter was found. Investigators were able to get a search warrant on Anna's office at the UT Dallas campus. In a locked drawer, they would find a handwritten letter in Russian written by Anna herself. An FBI agent even had to come to Texas to assist in the translation. They were able to deduce that the letter was actually a mixture of Russian and English written to her personal attorney. The contents of the letter were regarding a threat she received from Bob Moses during their divorce proceedings. The threat was dramatic and complicated. In the letter, Anna writes that Bob had threatened to kill himself and blame Anna for his suicide. Then Bob would go and write some sort of note to Igor placing blame on Anna for his death in an attempt to get Igor to hate and despise his mother as a result. This was an elaborate blackmail plan to basically get Anna to stay with Bob and not divorce him after all. Desperate to talk to Bob after the discovery of this letter, Police were able to lure Bob back to the station without suspicion, claiming that they had some information they needed to discuss with him about Anna's estate. They soon turned the conversation to Bob's alibi, and after checking with his roommate, Ken, he wasn't able to corroborate Bob's whereabouts after all. Bob doubles down and tells them, hey, you know what? Sorry, I wasn't keeping track of the time, but I was watching TV all day, and then I went to Twin Peaks, and that was it. There's nothing more than that. Crucially, though, the issue still stood that police believed Anna was killed an hour before Bob's 7 p.m. jaunt into Twin Peaks. This would leave him with unaccounted time and plenty of minutes to go to Anna's and kill her. Bob kept asking about his guns and if he could get them back or when they were going to be done testing them. He never once asked about the investigation and the aftermath of Anna's murder either. The one thing he did ask about, though, was Anna's will. Bob was under the assumption that he was actually the one to benefit from her estate and her life insurance policy. He had no idea Anna had recently changed the beneficiary to Igor rather than himself. Remember, the main motives for murder are love, greed, and revenge, and Bob Moses needed that money more than he let on. Police believed he was over his head financially, living in a house he could barely afford, needing to get three other roommates to help him pay for the mortgage. They also found it suspect when he moved right back into Anna's house with Igor after she died. The writing was on the wall, so to speak, and according to police, the motive to kill Anna was simply just for financial gain. But unbeknownst to him, Anna had ruined his entire plan when she removed Bob from her will, her estate inheritance, and her life insurance policy. After being confronted and denying involvement, Bob walked out of the interview room. But on February 26th, 2015, coincidentally, not only Bob's birthday, but my birthday as well, just 6 weeks after Anna's murder, Bob Moses was arrested. In late October of 2016, Bob's trial would begin. Representing the state was prosecutor Cynthia Walker. She knew the defense would try and cast doubt on the jury by parading around the plethora of other suspects as alternatives to Bob Moses. But in a pretty slick move, Cynthia preemptively calls those other men as her own witnesses instead, using them to her advantage early on. Each of these men testified and denied killing Anna. Cynthia's goal was to show the jury that all of these men, despite their connection to the victim, had concrete alibis and were investigated thoroughly. Moreover, through that investigation, they were subsequently proven to not be involved in Anna's murder. That is, except for Bob Moses. Critically, Cynthia even calls each of Bob's housemates to the stand to testify to his whereabouts on the day of Anna's murder. None of them vouch for Bob, claiming they never saw him at the house that day since most of them weren't there either. Texas Ranger Mankin is also called to the stand to testify and give the jury his theory on what happened to Anna that day. He believed Anna arrived home around 5:50, checked her mail, and entered the garage where Bob was waiting. He shot her 7 times, spreading 4 extra random shell casings on the floor after the fact. He took Anna's car, parked it a few streets away, tossing in the random cigarette butt and Red Bull can, wiping down the car's steering wheel and door handles. The evidence he pointed out after investigating came across as forced, staged, or just purposefully placed to throw off the investigation in a random direction. In an effort to prove that Bob had committed this murder with some sense of forethought or premeditation, Cynthia called to the stand one of Anna's Russian friends. The woman testified that back in December of 2012, Anna called her crying and in distress from a locked bedroom. Anna was begging her, asking her if she could come and stay at her home, and that she had called the police but was worried that Bob might kill her. If all of the witness testimony wasn't enough, DNA evidence was about to seal the deal on Bob Moses' guilt. Remember the blood found in Anna's car. Yeah, he was a match to the DNA found in the vehicle. Well, technically it was a mixture between Anna and Bob, but I'll let you make your own decision on that. Ranger Mankin believed the blood came from a small cut on Bob's hand that he noticed during his first interview. Bob's defense team, however, still deserved their shot at the jury as well. Toby Shook and Cody Skipper, I think we have discussed Toby in the Dina Schlosser case, I believe, they did their best to give Bob a fair fight. It was an interesting take, to say the least. They told the jury that the card that was used to purchase the Taco Bell was actually missing from Anna's wallet and was never located, pointing to possible evidence of a robbery. The evidence law enforcement and the prosecution believed Bob planted, the cigarette and the Red Bull can, they said were simply just pieces of evidence police never tested or bothered to even look into. The defense also tore apart the testimony given by Anna's friend, claiming she had called her, fearing Bob was going to kill her. Shook and Skipper reminded the jury that that was 2 years before the murder even occurred, and Bob and Anna had maintained an amicable friendship post-divorce and remained on good terms, you know, co-parenting Igor. And Bob also helped Anna around the house with, like, handyman chores, fixing things and doing little odd jobs around the house. Lastly, the defense tried to cast doubt on the state's timeline. They pointed out the video from the house in the neighborhood, and they said that was anything but definitive. It was black and grainy. You couldn't even tell what make or model or color the vehicle was. All they could tell really was that it was a similar sedan, the same like size and shape to Anna's car. They also reminded the jury of the last known and proven place Anna was seen at, the Taco Bell at 5:37. In court, they showed the wrappers and trash found at the scene to the jury, showcasing that a chicken quesadilla had been eaten. But by who? The defense called their own expert witness, a pathologist, claiming that if Anna had eaten the chicken quesadilla 10 minutes before her death at around 5:55, like the prosecution is putting forward in their timeline, it would have still been in her stomach during her autopsy. But it wasn't. As a matter of fact, no Mexican food was in Anna's stomach at all. They believed if she did eat the quesadilla at the proposed time of 5:55 or 6 o'clock, Anna must have been killed hours later, giving her time to digest the food before death, leaving no trace in her system. This means if the timeline is off, Bob's alibi of being at Twin Peaks is more secure than they had been led to believe and ostensibly puts him in the clear. Additionally, if the timeline is wrong, it puts into question the alibis of all of the other possible suspects law enforcement and the prosecution had put forward. The defense argued that the detectives should have submitted the trash for latent print testing, touch DNA testing, things like that, but none of that was actually done. They were trying to make the jury believe Bob was a victim in his own right, a victim of poor and lazy police work. In a last-ditch effort to help Bob Moses, they called their key witness to the stand, which was Igor Moses. He told the courtroom that he desperately loved both Bob and Anna and wholeheartedly didn't believe that Bob was guilty of this crime. He explained that following his mom's death, he and his grandmother had actually asked Bob to move back into the house. It wasn't this nefarious financial scheme like the state was making it out to be. He even took a jab at the physical evidence, the blood in Anna's car. He claimed the stains in the vehicle had been there for quite some time, even dating probably all the way back to when he was in high school. Plus, the scratch on Bob's hand was just that, on his hand. Not on his arm or his back or his butt, correlating where the stains were found on the seat and the console. It was also tiny, not a wound that would drip large, solid drops of blood like the evidence showed. Unfortunately, they couldn't timestamp the bloodstains, and it was Igor's word against scientist. The defense also put forward that nothing placed Bob in the garage or Anna's house. All of his guns were tested and came back clear, not having been fired or used in Anna's murder. No witness saw Bob enter or arrive at the home. He didn't even have a key. There were no fingerprints, no camera footage, no murder weapon. They also argued that there was no other physical evidence in the garage, only in the car, and that was questionable at best. The jury had heard from friends, lovers, co-workers, experts, detectives, and even Anna's son, and now they were left to decide the fate of Bob Moses. After 7 days and 40 witness testimonies, they deliberated for 8 hours the first day, but went home for the night. Anything was possible at this point. There was a lot to review and still to mull over. The next morning, however, they told the judge they had come to a decision. The jury found Bob Moses guilty, and he was sentenced to life in prison. Igor was not present for the verdict. Bob Moses is incarcerated at the McConnell Unit in Beeville, Texas. How cute. I don't think we've ever had a defendant there. He is eligible for parole in 2046, meaning he will most likely die in prison, seeing that he is currently 71 years old. And that is the murder of Anna Moses. Let's do some questions and theories. I am going to play devil's advocate on this one. I think it's Occam's razor when it comes to this case, but I still have some questions. So if he did it, right, how did Bob get into her house? That was never answered. There was no mention of a key. Did he open a window? Was the garage door able to be lifted? I mean, the door was locked when police arrived, so Igor was the only one with a key. I mean, maybe during all of his handyman trips, Bob made a copy of a key that Anna or Igor didn't know about, but I don't know. That part was just skimmed over, so. How did anyone not hear or see the shooting if the garage door was open? Because that's what everyone in the courtroom was putting forward, that the garage door was open. I feel like that's also crazy. I know that the one guy was on a conference call, but like, come on, like an open garage door shooting, maybe 100 to 200 feet from you. I think that you would hear that over your headphones, or at least it would make some sort of noise that where you'd be like, wait, what the fuck was that? But I don't know, maybe not. I'm not doubting the shooting didn't take place or anything, obviously, but I just think it's weird on the neighbor's part, but whatever. He was weird anyway. So did Bob like park a few streets over himself, like drop her car off and then take his own home? Was there any camera footage of that? Obviously not. It probably would have been brought up. What about car keys? Where were those found? Like, were they in his house? Were they left in the car, you know, next? Like, how did that, you know, where did that play out? Where's that evidence? Why even take the car and move it? I guess to make it look more like a robbery or a carjacking, I guess. I don't know. Maybe according to police, to give him time to plant the cigarette in the Red Bull can or something. I still think that that is a sketchy sort of explanation. But speaking of which, whose DNA came back to the cigarette and the Red Bull can if it wasn't Bob's or Anna's? They said it was an unidentified male. So like that guy, if he was in the system, could have totally possibly been maybe framed for this. So that's fun. So the stomach contents aspect is interesting. I don't know, that to me throws some doubt on the whole timeline. Do I think it's weak? Yeah, kind of, but it's still interesting nonetheless. But like, why would she still be in her coat and scarf if she had come home, eaten, and then was killed later? Like, I guess maybe she could have gotten dressed again for her date and went out to the garage for something, but I don't know about the quesadilla evidence. It just doesn't totally fit, but it's a good effort, I guess. The fact that he waited 2 years to kill her is weird. Why wait that long? You'd think that he would realize that he was in financial stress long before that if he was living in a house with three other guys. I mean, it was also a really nice house, so was he in that big of a financial bind? I don't know. You'd also think that he would have looked into the insurance thing before doing something so permanent. Like, is he that dumb to think that after they got divorced, he would still be the beneficiary? I don't know. How was Bob so calculated? This is good. How was Bob so calculated to steal a random cigarette and Red Bull can to plant at the scene, but not calculated or smart enough to notice the blood stains left behind? Or double check with Anna and Igor about the insurance benefits. That's like huge. I don't know. Interesting. I guess criminals are dumb, but like kind of smart in that sense, but not all the way. So his roommates testified in court that they weren't really at the house that day either. So how do they know if Bob was there or not? That's fucking vague and loose at best. Not super tight. Hence why I said loose. Bob also gave consent to all of his guns and his house and his DNA. That's a bold move all the way around for someone who's guilty. I feel like I've watched too many fucking First 48s and 48 Hours and 60 Minutes and Dateline for them to be like, no, if you're guilty, you definitely give over your DNA. No, that's someone who doesn't think that A, they're going to get caught, or B, that they are totally 100% innocent. Giving away your DNA and all of your shit that could have been used in a murder, like, that's a big fucking bold claim of innocence. And then for it to all come back negative, minus the blood? Don't know. What about the credit card? Did they ever find that? How would anyone know that that was the one she used to buy her food? Why take the card but not the $300 cash? Like, maybe she used it to buy the food and it got lost in the car somewhere. You know, maybe it was just never found by investigators, but his defense team decided to use that as something. I don't know. If it wasn't Bob or any of the other men that they looked at, then who was it? Because like, it has to be him, right? I don't know. I always feel like I fucking doubt everything and question every case. And even though I feel like at the end of the day, Bob did it simply due to the fact that he was the only one with real motive, I guess, besides Igor, who I still think is semi-sus and weird. I mean, he didn't even show up for the verdict. Maybe he had class again. I don't know. But yeah, I think Bob did have motive and something to potentially gain from Anna's death. At least at one point he did. And the alleged phone call between Anna and her friend is telling, and the letter to her attorney shouldn't be looked past either. So again, who knows? I do think Bob's attorneys did a good job at trying to defend him and gave him a leg to stand on. So I don't know. He probably did it, but whatever. Anyways, that is all I have for you today. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Sorry for the long rant and the dumb questions and theories, but please rate and review the podcast and come back for episode 75. I have a good one. At least I think it's a good one. So yeah, if you have a suggested case, reach out to me via email or Instagram. But yeah, I will be back with more Texas true crime. So if anyone is listening, happy Halloween.